It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 75 for Friday the 11th of May, 2012. On the show today, the Queen has confirmed the government's web surveillance plans, but what exactly do they involve? Also, David Cameron is considering forcing ISPs to adopt a opt-out porn block. And have you heard of an extreme dwarf mammoth? We hadn't, but that's hit the news this week. All that and more coming up. Ahoy, and of course, ahoy there, Nate Langston here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me this week in the Trinket Cupboard, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And we have no Duncan Gear this week because he's at the Great Escape Festival.
Yeah.
But he will make his presence known in our stories this week. I must apologise in advance, by the way. Can you hear this, Liv? My voice, my husky voice.
You sound like a really poor Darth Vader impressionist.
Thanks. That's fine. No, I've been not very well. Not very well. But a quick bit of housekeeping to get to, actually, before we get to the show. We have been doing this now for, what, a year and a half, Liv?
Year
and a half? We've chart-topped.
75 episodes.
You know, yeah, 75 episodes in. And we're very keen to hear about what people like, what they maybe like less, what they'd like to hear more of specifically, and what they'd like to hear us keep in the show as we go through the next year and a half of podcasts. Do let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk. Let us know your feedback. We won't take offence, but keep it nice. Keep it positive. Keep it, what's the word?
Constructive,
Thank
I think
you.
Is the word.
That's the one. That's the one. Anyway, let's crack on with some news, shall we? The Queen, Mrs. Queen, has confirmed the government's web surveillance plans, Liv. I'm intrigued. How am I being spied on?
Yeah, well, we've talked about this a couple of times in the past, I think, but the government has laid out some web surveillance plans that have been alluded to several different times. And the idea is to force ISPs to store data relating to their customers' communications and then let intelligence agencies access them in real time. In the past, they've been able to, if they've suspected someone of being a terrorist or a serious criminal, they've been able to get a court order to then be able to access some of their communications. But not all of this level of detail within online communications and not in real time without getting a court order.
So this would actually enable an agency that was perhaps suspecting somebody of terrorist activity or involvement to actually look at the web pages that they are browsing and actually look at their IM conversations, like over MSN or Skype.
Yeah, they wouldn't be able to see necessarily the content, but they'd be able to see who they're talking to, when they're talking to them, and across all third-party kind of messaging clients. I mean, the Queen doesn't give very much details, but she just, in her May speech, she outlines all the different bills that are going to be coming through in the coming year. And so she said, "My government intends to bring forward measures to maintain the ability of law enforcement and intelligence agencies to access vital communications data."
That word vital always springs to mind. I mean, the Serious Organized Crime Agency is obviously one of the parties that would have access to this, and they have been involved recently in things like anti-piracy efforts, which has involved the closing down of certain prolific websites. Now, this gives me pause, because although they use the word terrorism, and we always think about things like combating child sex abuse on the web, because some of these agencies have been involved, and because of the pressures of the record industry to tackle piracy, this gives me a little bit of concern that this could be used for perhaps not always the terroristic reasons.
And I think that's why there's understandably a lot of concern about this. I mean, there are no more details at this stage, and she did say that the measures would be brought forward under strict safeguards to protect the public, subject to scrutiny of draft clauses. So at this stage, you know, we haven't got this new legislation yet, but it should be coming in under the Communications Data Bill.
Because this is deep packet inspection, this isn't, you know, just taking your computer. This is akin to getting the Royal Mail to say, "We can inspect the contents of all the letters that you're sending through our system."
And who you're sending it to,
when you're sending it. Now, it sets a very dangerous precedent, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there, just being able to have access to this means that there is a huge potential for security breach as well. It's something that ISPs don't necessarily collect already, and now they'll have to. So anyone, if there was any a vulnerability in their systems, that there'd be a huge, huge level of data that people could get hold of. And I think that's why there's so much opposition.
And I mean, this actually came up, didn't this come up in the previous government? This is something that they originally had proposed, and it never actually really went anywhere. And there were so many questions over, I mean, who funds it? I mean, it's a huge amount of data that ISPs would have to collect.
Yeah, it was proposed under the Labour government, and it was referred to by civil rights campaigners, civil liberties campaigners, as the snoopers charter. And actually, the current government was really against it at the time, and said there's no need for us to actually collect more data on people. We just need, we need to look after our citizens. We don't need to snoop on them. But they've done a complete about face, and so it'll be interesting to see whether they can uphold this attitude.
Well, we'll be keeping our eye on it, of course. We've got various stories on the website already. We will keep you up to date as this progresses. David Cameron, also just staying on the topic of internet privacy, let's say.
Yeah.
David Cameron is considering forcing ISPs into an opt-out porn block. This would mean, basically, that porn sites would be blocked by default, and if you wanted to access porn sites, you would have to contact the ISP and say, I don't want this filter on, please unblock my smut. This, again, kind of worrying precedent here.
I mean, this has all come out of some, there's been lots of reports about child safety online, and whenever children are mentioned, people get very, very emotional, and it's easy to make kind of knee-jerk decisions based on that. But there was a parliamentary inquiry looking at online child safety, and obviously you've got to protect kids from predators and seeing, you know, smutty material if it's that easily available. But there's this idea that has been proposed to do it at a kind of technical level, at the ISP level, as opposed to actually parents taking control of their kids and, you know, teaching them boundaries or not giving them access to the web the whole time. And I think it's completely going about it the wrong way.
Absolutely. The thing that struck me is that we've recently had the .xxx domain name approved, which was considered because if porn sites were made to use .xxx, it would make it easier to filter just those domains out. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that approach. This strikes me as kind of making all that a moot point. I mean, what's the point in having a specific, domain name for adult content if you're going to circumvent the regular content anyway? I mean, it's...
But then I guess that, you know, the content isn't at the moment all stored on .xxx domains as it stands. I mean, there was a really great piece by Charles Arthur in The Guardian, actually, that was arguing exactly the same point. We shouldn't be regulating the internet. We should be regulating our kids. Mm. And, to put the responsibility onto ISPs is a bit ridiculous.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a... I mean, I'm not a parent. I don't have children. I'm not privy to the best ways to do that, but it makes me kind of angry to think, well, this is not everyone's going to want to call up their ISP and say, excuse me, can you turn my adult filter off, please? That's embarrassing. For me, I wouldn't care. I'd be quite happy. I'd say, yo, turn it off. I'm not saying I want to access porn, but I don't want you blocking anything. But not everyone would be like that. Not everyone would know about it. They'd have the wherewithal to actually say, okay, I need to contact my ISP. I mean, it's just...
And also, these kind of filters are pretty crude. They don't just filter... I mean, I don't even know how they would filter out adult content, because that presumes that you have to have a site somehow marked as an adult content containing site. But there's such grey areas on this.
The filters don't often work that well. Quite funny, the other day we'd written, I actually think it might have been our story about this, and Duncan, who I think wrote this story for us, had said he'd sent a link to one of his friends and they couldn't view it at work because they had a filter that blocked out things that it thought was adult material, because we'd said, you know, things like porn and pornography and stuff like that all the way through the story. He couldn't read it.
That's brilliant.
I mean, that's testament to these filters being absolutely ridiculous. And
presumably that means that stories that are anti-pornography would also get picked up by the very same filters.
Yeah. I remember once one of my personal blogs got flagged as being blocked for being hateful or something like that for some school filter.
Wow.
I know, kind of bizarre. But again, we'll keep our eye on this, and hopefully we'll keep smut where it belongs, available but controlled. Amazon is going to be investing in high-end fashion, according to its CEO, Jeff Bezos. He's revealed that Amazon is going to make a, quote, significant investment into attracting high-end fashion brands. Amazon apparently reportedly shooting 3,000 fashion images a day. It's hired models, makeup artists, and stylists, and is using a special photo studio that apparently incorporates patent-pending technology. Now, this is quite interesting. I mean, I know that the reason for this is financial, because there's such a high margin on high-end fashion, and because there's no... Bezos was arguing that there's no difference in advertising and promoting, you know, a different type of product. It's so you can make more money from selling these sort of high-end fashion goods, so it makes sense. But there have been a lot of sites that have tried and failed in history to actually do fashion well, because obviously it's one of those things that you need to try it on.
Yeah, I don't think it's about the fact that you can't buy, you won't buy fashion online. I think Amazon's good because of its scale, and it can get cheap stuff, you can get great deals, and it sells everything. But fashion's something that I feel like you want a more luxurious experience of the actual online experience. And that's why you have beautiful websites like Net-a-Porter and stuff like that, where they really focus on making it a kind of beautiful, beautifully designed, interactive website. Whereas Amazon's all about buy it quick, buy it now, buy it one click. I don't know. I mean, I guess they're taking lots of pictures, it'll probably end up looking something like ASOS.com or something.
Perhaps, but I think that it's very interesting. Whatever they're doing, they're obviously he says they're making a significant investment.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if they're doing something so creative, you have to believe that it's involving some sort of 3D imaging technology. Mm. I mean, if we remember Boo.com back in the day, it was at the dot-com boom. I mean, it's kind of, Boo was one of the best examples of a dot-com startup going belly up, let's say. I mean, massive amounts of investment, spending huge amounts of money, tried to make something that was wrong for the market at the time it launched. But something like Boo.com would actually work very, very well now.
Yeah.
This kind of massive, very heavy website, very flashy, lots of interactivity, you know, 3D photography, stuff like that. Amazon could pull that off now. Broadband being what it is means that sort of online experience is accessible to everybody.
Mm.
And I think Amazon's got the money to make something like that work quite well.
I think it'll still have to work quite hard to create that rich environment that people who are going to spend a lot of money on clothes are looking for.
Well, they've got some serious designers involved. I'm talking about fashion, Liv.
Yeah, I know. This is ridiculous.
It's kind of hilarious.
No, but you've heard of Vivienne Westwood.
Well, that's why I put her in our show notes, because Vivienne Westwood is one of the designers that's already signed up and is on board. There are a whole bunch of others. I've never heard of any of them. I have no idea if they're important, but they're in our story, so I'm guessing they are. So I don't know. It feels like whatever they're doing something with the intention of it being very grand.
Yeah.
Probably very technologically advanced compared to maybe what's on the market already. But it's interesting.
So another sector that Amazon can dominate.
Yeah. We'll keep our eye on that as well. I've said that a lot. I need to stop saying that. Liv, spacesuits, Mars rovers, Austrian ice caves. The connection bitter.
Yes, this is an awesome story. The Austrian Space Forum and various other colleagues working on different Mars missions have been testing spacesuits and equipment in ice caves in Austria.
Wow. I've seen the photos of this, actually.
Yeah.
The photos look incredible. But this was a five-day mission?
It was a five-day mission. It took place in the Dachstein region of Austria. And the reason they're doing it in these ice caves is because... any potential mission to Mars, any manned mission to Mars, will be looking for life. And they say that if there was life on Mars, the most obvious place to look is in the lava canals, which are these underground caves that have been carved out during ancient volcanic eruptions. And because they'd be kind of shielded from cosmic rays, and they've kind of got a consistent temperature. And so what they wanted to do is practice, you know, this kind of supposed mission and use all the different equipment to see... how it would work. And one of the coolest things that they had down there is this spacesuit. I think it's, what's it called?
It's an exoskeleton, isn't it?
It's a kind of exoskeleton spacesuit that makes the body feel as though that they're walking on Mars. And it's got all the kind of communication systems and you know, all the data about your bodily health being fed into a little screen that appears inside the helmet. And the reason they have to do this is because if an astronaut is going to Mars, it'll take 26 minutes for them to send a message back to Earth. So if they're in any kind of trouble physically, they need to have much more access to information, because it'll take more than about an hour to get any kind of feedback from ground control.
Yeah, it'd be pretty bad if you waited half an hour for that response and it's, pardon?
Yeah, sorry, can you repeat that, please?
Yeah, I'm having a heart attack.
Yeah.
But I mean, this sort of stuff does happen. I mean, this isn't the first experiment into kind of like a fake mission. There was one,
no.
I think it took place in Russia,
where
they were in a capsule that simulated the flight from Earth to Mars.
Yeah.
And they were in there for the actual amount of time.
It was 2 years, I think, wasn't it? I think they spent 2 years and they had a couple of days out where they did some experiments and then they've got back in the capsule. I don't know if they've come out yet.
I think they have. I think we reported on it about several months ago. ago.
But they then had to sit in this tiny capsule with, however, I think, 8 men and for another 2 years.
Yeah. But I think it's pretty cool. They had rovers in there as well, didn't they? Like space rovers and 3D cameras and things.
Yeah, space rovers. They did some scanning equipment and they did some little kind of boring into the ice and trying to do kind of find microbiology and stuff like that.
Ironically, not boring at all.
No, not boring.
Yeah, you see what I did there?
Yes.
It was good, wasn't it?
Not that good.
No. Okay, let's move on to mammoths. A miniature meter-high mammoth lived in Crete. Do you know why this is interesting, Liv?
Well, it's interesting because it's a mini mammoth that doesn't need anything else other than that.
Okay, I'll start differently then. A fossil, basically, was discovered by paleontologists at the Natural History Museum in London, and it is from one of the smallest mammoths ever known to have lived. But what's really interesting about this is that the fossil was actually discovered in 1904, but was originally thought for a whole century that it was from a really small elephant. It turns out that it was a tiny extreme dwarf mammoth, which is about the size of a baby elephant, and lived in Crete, or at least the fossil was found in Crete.
Oh, this is so awesome.
Isn't
that much closer to having those miniature elephants which we can have as pets. This is brilliant.
But you know what's really interesting about this? I mean, this was discovered, they did some more analysis on one of this fossilized tooth, I think, and they found that it was more consistent with mammoths than with elephants.
Yeah.
And they sort of put two and two together. But what's quite interesting is that it's known that species living in isolation on tiny little islands can evolve to be smaller and over time.
Because they don't have predators.
I guess so, yeah. But we've observed this in various different species. But this is the first time that anyone has found this occurring with mammoths.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. This thing was tiny. It only weighed about 350 kilograms or something.
Oh my God, it's a pocket size almost, but very big pockets.
Also extreme dwarf.
Immediately, we need to get some elephants onto an island and leave them for a long time and see what happens.
I agree. Completely agree. Okay, well, anyway, let's have a not mammoth ad break. But when we come back, what has Jimmy Wales been saying makes no sense?
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Delicious ad breaks. Liv, Jimmy Wales has been in touch with us this week and he's been consulted by the government for something.
He has.
What has he been consulted about?
So the government is looking to make taxpayer-funded academic research available for free online.
This is important, by the way, because Jimmy Wales is the co-founder of Wikipedia.
Yes.
Just in case anyone didn't know.
He's a pretty big cheese in the world of the web, and he also has been acting as a government advisor for a while now. But he rightly believes that it makes absolutely no sense to charge for research that the taxpaying public has already paid for, and then they'd have to pay again to access it, which is currently how it works with major publishers such as Elsevier and Springer.
And they make a lot of money off this as well, don't they?
They make a huge amount of money. Unlike every other publisher in the world, these academic publishers have consistently kept their profits at like 30% for year on year for the last kind of 10 years, I think. They've kind of sustained this level of profit because they've got a kind of stranglehold on all of the best academic journals, and they kind of package them up into these enormous packages that then universities that are conducting research need to access, and so pay hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions, to access these massive packages of journals every year.
But it's not just Jimmy Wales and Wikipedia that is behind this. That there are actually some very serious organisations showing their support as kind of a protest movement, really.
Yeah, at the moment there's this movement called The Cost of Knowledge, which is specifically targeting Elsevier, but we should remember there are lots of other academic publishers with similar models, Springer and Wiley-Blackwell being a couple of them. But there's more than 11,000 researchers have vowed to either not publish, edit or review studies. They can select all three of them if they want. So 11,000 researchers who would otherwise be doing these things have signed up in kind of a protest.
The Wellcome Trust's on board as well, aren't they?
Yes, they've said that they'll withhold funding unless researchers make their publications freely available.
Wow.
So there are models that this can work. I mean, in the US, we've got PLOS, which is an open access journal. The way the model works is you don't pay to view the papers. Instead, people pay to publish their own papers.
Hmm.
So there is a bit of kind of controversy about, you know, are you just kind of paying to get your piece in regardless of the quality of research? But they say that they only take the payment once they've been peer reviewed and they know that they're good enough to publish.
So, I mean, I'm guessing that the benefit here would directly benefit students particularly,
yeah,
not having to pay additional fees. I mean, students are getting shafted for their tuition fees at the moment anyway.
Well, most medical students would, or you know, people working in science would have access to a big library, but you have to have access to a big library which has paid a massive subscription. Or you have to pay for individual papers, and I think they can cost like £30 a pop, which is, you know, ridiculous. And the kind of improvements you could make with science by having more people accessing the studies is could be enormous.
What could people do if they want to show their support to this?
Well, they can go to this website, The Cost of Knowledge, if you are working in research, and you can sign a pledge to not to get involved in, well, this is specifically targeting Elsevier. Alternatively, I don't know.
I suppose a twibbon.
A twibbon.
I don't know. Slacktivism, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't know what else you can do.
Well, let's go to, you can go to that website, I guess, then. The Cost of Knowledge, Google that. Or just come to Wired and Google that. No. You know what I'm saying. Find it on our site. Let's move on, shall we? Duncan has written a story. He's not here, but I'm going to pick up one of his. And I can't help but think that his intro to this particular story was slightly aimed at me, which says, looking for love or perhaps just someone to go and see obscure folk metal bands with? I mean, I'm not looking for love, but the folk metal bit, perhaps.
But don't you already go and see those together?
Yeah.
So you're all right.
Yeah, I suppose so, Liv.
So Taste Buds FM might not be for you then.
Okay, yeah. The news is that music dating service TasteBuds.fm has arrived as a Spotify app. And the service is a bit quirky. It's been around for a year or two. And what it basically does is it pulls in your listening, the music taste of a listener using its service. And it matches them with people who have similar tastes. Ideally, people who are looking for a bit of love and sexy time. And this is now available through Spotify's new app platform, which launched, I think, a few months ago, which means that the service can scan what you've been listening to most recently, or I think listening to most on Spotify, and matching you up with another Spotify user who has been listening to similar music.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting. I was listening to a band this morning called Cattle Decapitation, which is an excellent,
yeah,
brutal death metal
band. I'd love to see who you got paired with.
It would be very interesting to see.
I think we should do an experiment.
My girlfriend might not approve.
Well, you don't have to go on a date with them. It's for science. Yeah.
Actually, one of the guys on the magazine did a feature. You know, Badu.
Yeah.
The Badu. He actually did try out a dating hookup service for science.
Yeah. Did he go and meet someone?
He didn't, but he signed up to the service and he chatted with them online and he was very honest about it. So I'm a journalist, I'm looking at this service, I'm wondering what your experiences is. But it must be fun to come home and say, what did you do today, darling? Well, signed up to a hookup service and chatted to, some hookers.
Yeah, received some extraordinary images sent to me.
Interesting. TasteBuds.fm on Spotify. Very keen to hear if it actually works. If you're on Spotify and use this service, let us know.
Well, I'm just trying to think of how many times that you've gone out with someone who definitely shares your music tastes.
Yeah, a lot of people who like the sort of music I like, though, you know, they're often quite different to me.
Yeah.
I don't think I come across as a sort of brutal death metal fan. Well, most of the time.
Occasionally.
Do I? Okay. Well, never mind. Anyway, we've got one more story we want to get to before we wrap up the show. Last week, we reported that a German court had ruled that Microsoft could not sell its Xbox games console, copies of Windows 7, or provide Internet Explorer or Windows Media Player in Germany. It was all over a patent dispute between Microsoft and Motorola. But fear not, German fans, your Xbox might not be banned after all, because a US judge has delayed his decision whether to allow the ban to actually take place, and actually chastised Microsoft and Motorola for using the court as, quote, a pawn in a global industry-wide business negotiation.
Naughty.
Scathing words. You do not want to anger a judge.
No.
Who can ban your products. Or not ban them, as the case may be. So, I mean, it's still developing. It's not a case that has concluded yet. It's likely to go on for some time. But fairly good news, I would guess, for Microsoft. Possibly not so rosy for Motorola.
Well, I'm sure they'll find another case to fight.
Yeah. It's probably a good thing, actually. Minecraft, you know, Minecraft.
Yeah.
Came out for Xbox this week. This isn't really a story. This is more of an afterthought. And has become the fastest selling Xbox arcade game ever released.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's really.
We got a lot of really angrily excited comments on our story about the review of the game.
It's absolutely brilliant. If you want a bit of a laugh, go on to wired.co.uk, search for Minecraft Xbox, and find the story that's something like Minecraft Xbox release date announced or something. Yeah. And have a look at some of the comments. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of very, very angry children.
Desperate for their access.
It's like they've been told there's a worldwide food shortage, but don't worry, you're going to get a meal in 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And then their responses would probably be quite similar. It's hilarious. It's good for a laugh. That's it, Liv. We have no feature this week. We have no Duncan. It's a short, sharp, powerful podcast. You know, one take podcast. We had a very sweet bit of feedback about our podcast already, actually. And so we wanted to say hi, because they're not expecting this, to the Bushlow High School guys. Apparently they play our podcast in their lunchtime ICT classes.
And we've been warned to keep our language child friendly. I don't know how old the class is.
I don't know. I'm curious. I don't think we border on the obscene.
No, but we did have a story that talked extensively about internet pornography at the start of this.
True. But that wasn't too bad.
No.
I don't know. But it's quite nice to know that we're now played in schools. You know, I know that there are people in government who listen to our podcast because they've, well, told us.
I feel an enormous sense of responsibility.
I know. It's crazy. We can't say all those words.
We have to actually make sense.
I know. It's crazy.
Well, anyway, hello Bushlow or Bushlow High School, however you pronounce it, in Leicestershire. Yeah.
Are you a high school? Do you have the podcast played in you? Do let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk, which is our email address for all feedback. Liv, how else can people get in touch?
Well, you can call us on 0208 123 0468 from a landline or a mobile, and it'll be charged at UK local rates. And you can also call us on Skype for free. Wired UK Podcast is our username, so give us a bell there. Leave us a message. 30 seconds?
30 seconds or less. 31 Maximum. Is acceptable. 32, you're having a laugh. Get out.
And we're also on Twitter. You can follow us on @WiredUK, and you can go and visit our fantastic Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WiredUK.
Got some exclusive competitions on there.
Have you? Which ones?
Good question, actually. Oh, we're giving away some Blu-rays at the moment.
Okay.
For some stuff. Gave away tickets to a world premiere of The Dictator last night.
Which you went to see?
I went to see. It's very good, actually. It's very silly. It's very good, though.
Not for the kids of Bushlow High School, perhaps.
Absolutely not, perhaps not. yes, and hopefully Duncan will be back next week when he's back from The Great Escape. Liv, it has been a pleasure.
Thanks, mate.
Bye.
Bye.
Loud, sniffling voice.